those of you who are in here, we'll just—that's fine. We can just this can be informal. What I'm going to do is, here we go. Here's a list of these are typical questions that Christians have if we've traveled around the world in our offices in seven countries and so on, church after church all around the world. You read Genesis, you hear about evolution, and we have questions about things that are in Genesis. These are typical questions that Christians have. If you see something up there, you can just shout out the number, and then we can talk about that. You don't have to ask questions off the screen. If something in Genesis has always bugged you, I mean, by all means, ask about that. But let's have it creation evolution focused, and have a question time. So, all right, any questions? Yes, number 10. Okay, was there an ice age? Yes, there was. Next question. Let's do a little more there. Yes, it was an ice age. It's kind of ironic because as Christians we think, well, you know, do we believe in an ice age? Or what do we do with the ice age? Is that just an evolutionary thing? Or what is it? Yes, there was an ice age, and it's ironic because as Christians we have a mechanism that produced an ice age. And the evolutionists have great difficulty generating an ice age. They're always playing with notions maybe the sun's radiation was lessened for tens of thousands of years, and let's plug that data into our weather, our climate simulation software, and that's how it's done nowadays. You change the radiation from the sun, greenhouse gases, ocean temperature, that kind of thing, and then hit go and see if an ice age will develop. And they're always, again, playing with notions like that, but that doesn't lead to an ice age. An ice age is characterized by the buildup of these kilometers thick glaciers and ice sheets that covered this part of Canada, like in the North and South Pole and so on. They grew, and you can't get that. If you cool down the whole Earth, you basically shut down evaporation from the oceans. So the Earth becomes colder, yes, but you don't get the buildup of the glaciers because you shut down evaporation from the oceans. What do you need to get an ice age? You need warmer oceans and cooler continents. You need cooler summers because the summers have to be cool enough so that the snow builds up year after year. If it melts away every summer, it's got to accumulate year after year. So as it turns out, a global flood is a perfect mechanism, a perfect trigger for getting an ice age going. Okay, so how does a flood get an ice age going? The Bible-believing scientists believe that there was one continent originally, broke up rapidly during the flood. You may have heard that in school, the continental drift. It's really continental sprint is what happened there. There's a powerful scientific model behind a rapid breakup of the original supercontinent. For those of you who got the Answers book, I think we're out now, or there's one left or something. There's a chapter in the Answers book about a continental drift, and it talks about that in more detail. So one continent, no Atlantic Ocean originally, then the continent breaks up. So if you're increasing the surface of the Earth in one location, that means in another location it's decreasing. So the pre-flood ocean plates, the ocean plates that God created, are being pulled into the Earth by gravity in some places. In other places, you've got basically molten, very, very hot rock coming from the base of the mantle, forming new ocean floor, like in the middle of the Atlantic. Any seawater that gets onto that area flashes to steam to rise into the atmosphere to form, you know, rain in just minutes or hours later, intense global rain. Some of the calculations suggest that process would produce global rainfall at a rate of 3 feet an hour. Just huge, very, very devastating. The point of all that is, with all that tectonic activity during the flood, the ocean water after the flood would have been a lot warmer than it is today. Well, that's condition number one met. More evaporation, warmer oceans. The oceans after the flood are pumping moisture into the atmosphere. Warmer water evaporates more readily than colder water. And that's the first condition. Now, what about the cooler continents? That's, again, a result of the flood. Because of the earth movements, that's earthquakes and volcanoes, volcanism on a level that that maybe we can't even imagine. Huge amount of volcanism, putting huge amounts of dust and pollutants into the atmosphere, shielding out the sun's energy, making the continents cooler. It's perfect conditions for an ice age. So the ice age begins right after the flood, lasts maybe 700 years or so. After 400 or 500 years, the ocean temperature is going to go down to kind of where it is today, and evaporation is going to slow down, which means precipitation is going to slow down. And then it's going to take years for those volcanoes that spewed the dust into the atmosphere. It's like probably centuries. after the flood, it doesn't mean that the earth was nice and tranquil again. It probably would have been violent earthquakes and tsunamis and all kinds of stuff going on for centuries after the flood until the earth settled down again. And so that you've got more and more dust in the atmosphere. But eventually, after a few hundred years, that's filtered from the atmosphere and the summers get warmer and the glaciers start melting back for a couple hundred years. And they're still melting back today. So we have a great explanation for the Ice Age. And during the Ice Age, that actually relates to another question up there. How did animals get to places like Australia after the flood? And some of you might be wanting to ask that because the kangaroo, for example, gets off the ark in the Middle East. Now it's in Australia. Australia's an island nation. Kangaroos don't swim. How'd it get there, right? Well, an Ice Age, and both creationists and evolutionists understand this, in an Ice Age, you're taking huge amounts of ocean water and storing it on land in these kilometers-thick glaciers. It would lower ocean levels by 300 to 400 feet. And whether you're Bible-believing or not, that's fairly well understood. Well, if you lower ocean levels today by only 200 feet, all of the continents, including Australia, are connected by land bridges. So the answer to how the kangaroo got from the Middle East to Australia might be as simple as it hopped. So there was a land bridge, Southeast Asia, going through Indonesia, and so on. And then at the end of the Ice Age, the water comes back up. And Australia is separated, and it's been suggested that the only reason kangaroos are in Australia today is because there's no natural predator, even today, in Australia for the kangaroo. Kangaroo fossils have been found all over the world, South America, Asia, that kind of thing, but they're not there anymore, maybe because they had predators in those areas, but even today, the kangaroo has no natural predator in Australia. So anyways, it all kind of fits together. Flood, Ice Age. Then about 100 years after the flood is when the dispersion from Babel happened. And right at that time, you've got all the continents connected by land. It's just, it's neat how it all kind of fits together. It's a coincidence, I'm sure. But yes, sir. Number one, how do dinosaurs fit into the Bible? We can go through that pretty quickly here. Start with when were they created? Well, dinosaurs are land animals. Land animals were made on day six. And so we can say that dinosaurs, from a biblical perspective, we can say that dinosaurs lived with people. And that's a shocker for some people today. But there's a book at the back. You can check it out when we're finished here. A big black hardcover book called Dire Dragons. And in that book, Vance Nelson, the author who's Canadian, lives out in Red Deer, is a Canadian guy. He's traveled around the world taking pictures of what any 10-year-old would tell you, hey, that's a dinosaur. Pictures of different art forms, paintings, tapestries, carvings, sculptures, and so on, of what are plainly dinosaurs. But those pieces of art have been made in the last few hundred years. For example, one of my favorite examples in the book is in Carlisle Cathedral. This is a cathedral in Carlisle, England. The cathedral was built in 1122, and in 1496... one of the bishops there, Richard Bell, he died. This was 1500, basically. He died, and they used to bury the folks in the floor of the church. He's still there today. So his tomb is in the church there. And around the edge of his tomb in the floor of the church is a brass band about yay big, and someone has engraved animals on it. There's birds, and there's fish, and there's dogs, and there's all kinds of different things. And there's dinosaurs. Clearly dinosaurs. You can see pictures of it in that book there. And so this is 1496. That's good evidence. See, in 1496, we didn't have museums. We know what dinosaurs look like because we can go to a museum and you can see the fossil reconstructions there and you kind of squint your eyes and imagine them with skin on and presto, we know what dinosaurs look like. But those people didn't have museums in 1496 in England. How would they have known what dinosaurs look like except that dinosaurs were still living in England at that time, along with all those other animals that are pictured there. People were living with dinosaurs. And there's evidence after evidence. That's just one example of dozens that Vance records in that book. It's a brilliant book. So dinosaurs, again, let's continue with our story. So day six, dinosaurs are land animals, by the way. There's the great flying reptiles like pterodon and pterodactyls, and the great sea reptiles like plesiosaur and chronosaurus and so on. Technically, if you want to be really accurate, those are not dinosaurs. We can call them the great flying reptiles and the great sea reptiles. Dinosaurs are land animals. That's one characteristic. Another characteristic is they have their legs straight down like cows or horses. not out to the side like alligators or crocodiles. People say, well, alligators or crocodiles, aren't those the leftovers of dinosaurs? No, they're reptiles. Dinosaurs have a unique physiology, unique bau plan in German, the way they're constructed. They're like reptiles, but they're not reptiles. And so, okay, so they're land animals, therefore were made on day six. Initially, the world was very good because people, right away, Jurassic Park enters your head, right? You dinosaurs and people together, that's not going to work. But the world was very good originally. That probably didn't last too long. One of the questions that people have is, okay, when did Adam and Eve sin? Maybe they were in the garden for thousands of years before they sinned. Well, most theologians think there's probably day seven or day eight that Adam, not very encouraging, but, and there's reasons for that. But anyway, so initially the world was very good. Dinosaurs would have been designed to eat plants. Everything would have ate plants. And then we think of another question that this leads to all kinds of other questions. Well, what about like T-Rex? That's one of the big famous ones. Had teeth up to 6 inches long, razor-sharp pointed teeth, serrated edges on both sides, basically a mouthful of steak knives, right? So you're thinking, well, what on earth was that thing doing with a mouthful of steak knives in a world where everything was vegetarian? Do you need that really? Well, some animals have powerful jaws and sharp teeth, and they eat most, like bears. They eat mostly berries, right? It works good as a rake. You put your mouth in there and scrape off all the berries. It kind of works fairly well. But there's another chapter in the Creation Answers book, actually, that talks about how did defense and attack structures come to be? Because if they weren't originally created by God in a very good world, how did that? That's another question that they have. So the short answer is, and we'll move on, T-Rex may have had different teeth originally. There's a possibility there. And then you've heard of genetics? Have you heard of epigenetics? Some of you have. All right. Epigenetics is very, very interesting. It portions of the genetic code can be switched on or switched off in certain environmental conditions, certain conditions that the organism experiences. All of a sudden, you have something completely different happening. For example, you know, locusts and grasshoppers have identical DNA, but they're very different, aren't they? It's like grasshoppers can become locusts under certain conditions, and that may help us understand the plagues, like the one locust plague there and that kind of thing. But they're grasshoppers, but then it's like a Jekyll and Hyde transformation. That's epigenetics. Epigenetics explains that. So maybe God put additional genetic information in some living things like T-Rexes before the fall. God knew that Adam and Eve would fall, so he put that information there and then switched it on at the time of the curse, so that now some animals would take their place in a very different food chain. Because initially the food chain is like this. Everybody just eats plants. Now we've got a food chain that's like this, right? The little guys eat the plants, and these guys eat the little guys, and they eat the plants, and the big guys just eat these guys at the top, right? Like T-Rexes and sharks and things like that. So anyway, there's an explanation. We're going into rabbit trails here. But back to dinosaurs. So let's move on through biblical history. Were dinosaurs on the ark? That's a lot of people lose it at that point. They say, absolutely not. Because the picture that we have of the ark in our minds, here's the ark, and here's dinosaurs. And here's the ark, and here, right? No, they wouldn't fit. You know what? The Bible says two of every, so a pair of every, seven pairs of some land-dwelling, air-breathing animals were brought to Noah. Dinosaurs are land-dwelling, air-breathing animals, so biblically, they had to go on the ark. And now people think that there's a simple solution to this because we're thinking of the big ones, right? You always immediately think Brachiosaurus, 40 feet tall, 4 stories tall in adulthood. But they didn't start that big. The largest dinosaur egg ever found is about this big, a little bit bigger than a football. So even Brachiosaurus it started small, right? It didn't start that big. God probably brought smaller dinosaurs to Noah, right? That's a simple solution. Don't bring grandma and grandpa. Bring the junior hires. You know, it's easy. So okay, dinosaurs were on the, biblically, dinosaurs were on the ark. They're land animals. They were on the ark. Then after the flood, what happened after the flood? They repopulated to some extent. There's great evidence for that. I mean, I showed you some. The soft tissue in the dinosaur bones there. I have trouble, even as a Christian who believes the Bible, understanding how those animals there with the soft tissue, were those some animals that were overcome at the time of the flood? The flood was 4,400 years ago or so. Could that stuff last for 4,000 years? Maybe. There's evidence that bone actually turns out is a fairly good preserver, like it's a really good Tupperware kind of thing. But could those animals, where the scientists have found the soft tissue in the bones, were those overcome maybe in spring flooding a few hundred years ago? Maybe, you know. But anyway, so dinosaurs repopulated to some extent after the flood. There's good evidence for that, like in Vance Nelson's book there that we talked about. But they've gone extinct. Why did they go extinct? They went extinct for the same reasons that species go extinct today. People think we have to come up with a brand new extinction theory for dinosaurs. There's plenty of reasons that species go extinct. Just pick one. Drought. You're what?
I was hungry.
You were hungry. Yeah, overhunting. Overhunting. There's an extinction theory today. Overhunting. We hunted whales nearly to extinction. And drought, disease, parasites, non-native species is introduced to their area and wipes them out. Competition with other varieties and so on. There's all kinds of reasons that animals go extinct today. Pick one of those. It's not real hard to see how dinosaurs fit into the Bible. But there's a brief history. If you want more information, there's a great chapter in the Creation Answers book on dinosaurs and how they fit that has more detail. And also the website. Website has tons of articles on dinosaurs in the Bible. Okay, lots of hands up. 15, okay. Where did Cain get his wife? That one comes up all the time. Now, Adam and Eve, you know what? The skeptics have a field day with that one. Do you remember taking Inherit the Wind in school? I remember taking, for some of us, it was a long time ago, the play Inherit, like the Scopes Monkey Trial in Dayton, Tennessee, creation versus evolution, that kind of thing. You know, the lawyers put themselves on the stand. It was the weirdest court ever. And the atheist lawyer put the Christian lawyer on the stand and started firing questions at him. Guess which question he asked him? Where did Cain get his wife? And you know what? The Christian lawyer, what was his name? What's his first? William Brady. William? Anyway, the Christian lawyer, he didn't know the answer. He said, I let the atheist hunt for her. that was his response. It's in the transcript of the court trial. But anyway, that's a big question. But I think most of you probably know the answer to where Cain got his wife already. But let's work through it anyway. You might be hesitant to say what it is. So Adam and Eve have Cain, Abel, and Seth. And then the Bible says, you know, Cain killed Abel, of course, and Seth was the replacement for Abel. And then Cain goes to the land of Nod, wherever that was, and there he finds a wife. So where'd she come from? Right? That's the challenge. And let me give you the wrong answer first, actually. And this has been taught at Bible colleges in the past. The wrong answer is, those people living in the land of Nod, they're not descendants of Adam and Eve. And then they would go on to teach their missionaries in training. They'd teach them, don't bother going to that tribe over there. They're not descendants of Adam and Eve. They can't be saved. Because if you haven't inherited the sin nature from your great ancestor Adam, then do you really need to be saved? And how does that work? But that's the wrong answer. That's not the right answer. What's the right answer? You put two verses in the Bible together and it points you in the right direction. Genesis 3 verse 20 says, Eve was the mother of all living. Okay, so no other people groups. Everybody who's ever lived on the planet ever has Adam and Eve as their great-great-great-great-grandparents. That's Genesis 3, verse 20. Genesis 5, verse 4 says Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters. And not just Cain, Abel, and Seth, but other sons and daughters. So you put those two verses together, and Cain would have married his? So you know the answer. But we're all, like I said, we're a little hesitant to say that, right? And there's two main objections that come up with that. And of course, again, the skeptics have a field day with this. The first objection is they say, no, that can't be the answer because if close relatives married, we'd all be insane by now, right? It's a biological objection. You have problems with your kids, right? And you got a wild group here, Pastor. This is great. Okay. The second objection that's raised is the first one is a biological objection. No, close relatives can't marry because they have problems with your kids. The second objection is a moral objection. People say it's just wrong. It's just wrong to do that. And sometimes they'll throw out this word incest. They'll use that. So let's deal with both of those. Start with a biological objection. Now, we're going to back up a little bit. We're all related anyway. right? Everybody in this room is related to everybody else in this room. And we're all related to Donald Trump. Or Justin Trudeau, if that makes you feel any better. I don't know. According to the Bible, everybody on earth goes back to Adam and Eve. So when you get married, you have to marry one of your relatives. Okay? Now, if you're married and you haven't married one of your relatives, you've married something that isn't human. Okay? Now look straight at me. Don't look at your spouse. Otherwise, you're going to get yourself in a ditch. So you have to marry someone you're related to. So why can't you marry someone you're closely related to? That's the question. And that's because of mutations. All of us have tens of thousands of mutations. And looking around the room, I can see some of them, right? And you know what I mean, right? Our noses aren't quite straight, and our ears might not line up, and that kind of thing. We have mutations. And if you marry someone you're closely related to, chances are you'll have the same mutation at the same location, hence you get a problem with your kids. So what you want to do is marry someone further away in relation to you. Hopefully their good information will overwrite your bad and vice versa, and you'll have healthy kids. So if we think of these mutations have crept in over time. We live in a sin-cursed world. That's probably the number one cause of extinction. Genetic drift is what scientists call it. And it's not just humans. It's all living things. We're getting genetically weaker over time. And then you have some slight disease that comes in or some slight bit of climate change, and bang, it wipes out the species. And so it's actually genetic decay that's causing species, the number one cause of extinction. It amplifies it anyway. So if we think of these mutations in the past, were there more mutations or fewer? Fewer, right? And you can go back and back in time until there's no mutations. Hey, that sounds a lot like in the beginning God, right? Initially, it wasn't a biological problem for close relatives to marry because they didn't have the mutations that we have today. So, and there was nobody else on the planet anyways. So that's the first objection dealt with. What about the second objection? People say, well, that's just wrong, and they sometimes throw this word incest. But does anybody know when did the law against close intermarriage come? Moses, yeah, the Levitical law. Now you shall no longer approach your close relation. And maybe God put that in place at that time because mutations were building up, and the Bible's not a science textbook, so God didn't say, well, because the human genome is now deteriorating to a point where... He just said, don't marry your close relative. End of discussion, right? And so it's... And initially, it had to be close relatives marrying anyways. There was nobody else on the planet. And it was the same thing after the flood, right? You have Noah and his wife and their three sons and their wives, eight people in total. The cousins must have married each other. And see, and it wasn't wrong. Even in Genesis 12, Abraham marries Sarah. Sarah is his half-sister. And it's not morally wrong at that point. See, it's God that sets the rules, not us and not the government. The government can pass laws and make things legal and illegal, but that doesn't mean they're right or wrong. Hopefully, most of the time, that should line up, but in many cases, it doesn't. Right? God sets the rules, not us. And so God set the rule at the time of Moses. Now it's wrong. Now to marry a close relative, it is wrong now because God sets the rules, and now there is a rule. So anyway, there's the answer to where Cain got his wife, and then the follow-up to the two objections that come from that. Yes, you've had your hand up the whole time. Number six is there good evidence that animals do change over time? You know what? There is excellent evidence that animals change over time. Farmers know all about this. They can breed different pigs or horses or cows or whatever for different purposes and that kind of thing. That's artificial selection where people do the selecting, and we can breed different types of crops together and get higher yields and stuff. It's good stuff. It's very, very helpful. And that happens also out in nature without any input from people. Climates change and that kind of thing. And so living things do change and adapt. But the types of changes that scientists see in living things, for example, at the smallest levels when they study the DNA, they're not the kinds of changes that are necessary to evolve, like, for example, a single cell into something like a horse or a human. They're the wrong kinds of changes that scientists are seeing. Yes, animals change. And there's many, many good examples of animals changing over time. Both artificial and natural selection. It happens. It happens all the time. You don't look exactly like your parents, right? You might say, well, thank God. but you see, you're different than your parents, right? And that's just, It's just you have some in your instruction code that runs your body. There's in all of your trillions of cells. You're made up of trillions of cells. Did you know that? You started off as one cell inside your mom. We won't talk about where that came from, but one cell inside your mom, and then you have the information to build you and that your body works on, the instruction code that runs your body. It's called the genetic code. It half of it came from your dad, half of it came from your mom. So you've got some, you kind of look maybe a little bit like your mom in places, a little bit like your dad in places, right? So there's a similarity there, but you're different. And your kids, if you get married and have kids one day, your kids will be different than you. And they'll be different than their grandparents, than your parents, right? And so changes happen. We understand that. Changes happen all the time. So living things do change genetically. It happens all the time, yeah. But it's not evolution. Other questions? Yes. Yeah, we do get that question quite often, and so there's kind of an article where our scientists globally got together and said, okay, all right, we're getting this question all the time. What's the consensus? And there's different people on staff that have different views. I'll give you the view of Mike Ord. Mike Ord has done he's a meteorologist. He's a weatherman. He's done a lot of work on a post-flood ice age. There's a book back there called Life in the Great Ice Age. It looks like a kid's book, but it's a very information-dense kid's book, so it works really good for adults, too. And the great thing about kid's books is that we can all understand them, right? But it's a great information on the Ice Age. He's a weatherman. He gets this question all the time. And I heard him give an answer to this at one of our bigger conferences once where we had him there. And he said, look, he's got a scrapbook of newspaper clippings back in the day of weather stories, interesting weather stories, as a guy who's interested in weather. Back in the 70s, you remember what they're saying? He's got newspaper clippings of. You remember what they're saying about climate change in the 70s? Anybody? Ice age coming. Yes. Ice age coming. And that was the talk at that time. In fact, on Facebook, I put up a picture a little while ago of two Time magazine covers, one from 1977, that the tagline was "How to Prepare for the Coming Ice Age." Okay. That didn't happen. And then one from 2010 that had a polar bear jumping from a piece of ice onto another piece of ice and be worried, be very worried. Well, Mike Ord's perspective is, as a weatherman, as somebody who studied this all his life and is now retired, is that that is a normal part of the cyclic variation of global temperature around an average. In the 70s, was there some data to suggest it was getting colder? Yes, there was some data. 60s and 70s, it seemed to be going down. And the idea is, from the fear mongers, is that, oh, it's gonna keep going and going. Well, no, it doesn't. It plateaued, and in the 80s and 90s, there was some data to suggest that temperature was increasing. Now, has it plateaued, and is it going the other way now? NASA, some data coming out of NASA suggests it is. There's other satellite data that isn't affected by ground-based variations or whatever. Satellite data suggests there's been no temperature variation at all in the last 30 years. So today, we're stuck with conflicting data, or conflicting reports of the data. I mean, what is the real data? You really, really got to scratch your heads. Okay, well, are the satellites wrong? What's the deal there? And then what about the ground-based temperature monitoring? Is that wrong? One of the things that, see, we had Al Gore's movie there whenever that came out, and he said by 2050, we have a long enough timescale now that we can see that the predictions made by the fearmongers years ago are wrong. He said in 2013 that the polar ice caps are going to be totally melted. The Antarctic ice sheet is larger than it has ever been recorded, ever, at this point. So, and Arctic is growing again now. So that there's, I mean, the predictions are wrong on these global warming climate models. So you gotta, our perspective is, just wait for more data. Yeah, because, and there's two questions there, right? There's, is there global warming? That's one question. And they're often lumped together. Is there global warming? And are we the bad guys? Are we the cause of it? Now, there's volcanoes, single volcanic eruptions that have spewed more CO2 greenhouse gases into the atmosphere than the entire Industrial Revolution. Like, you know, is you got to really scratch your heads when you look at the and another thing. The global warming folks seem to have cause and effect backwards. They're saying that because we're the bad guys and we're pumping more CO2 into the atmosphere, therefore that's going to cause global. So the cause is more CO2. The effect is going to be higher temperature, global warming. That seems to be backwards. It seems to be that the temperature may have been going up because of increased solar activity. It's like you build a bigger campfire, you're going to keep yourself warmer principle, right? And so the Earth has maybe been getting warmer according to some data. And because of that, the oceans release more CO2. So it seems that they've got cause and effect backwards. The temperature is going up not because of CO2, but because of increased solar activity. And the ocean responds, the creatures in the ocean, by releasing more CO2. That seems to be fairly well understood. But anyway, go to the website, type in global warming. There's a number of articles. It's not really a creation evolution thing. So we don't focus on that really much as a ministry, because that's something that's happening now. It's not about origins. It's about what's happening now. So, but anyway, we did it anyway here. So there we go. Yes. Okay, all right. Okay, yeah, let's just talk about that a little bit. Yeah, we wouldn't say it's fake. In fact, I love carbon dating. It provides powerful evidence that the Earth is young and supports the biblical time frame, actually. Now, carbon dating, the other terms that I think I maybe use is radioisotope dating or radiometric dating. Those are kind of interchangeable terms, and different scientists favor different ones. It doesn't really matter. But carbon dating, by the way, has nothing to do with millions of years. Okay, carbon dating is a little bit different than the other dating methods that do give the millions and billions of years. Carbon dating dates things that were once living. The other methods date rocks. Carbon dating dates things that were once living, and it dates it back to the time of death. Now, here's how it works. You've got nitrogen-14 in the atmosphere. It's hit by high-energy radiation from space, high-energy particle from space, which converts it into carbon-14. That's radioactive. Carbon-12 is the normal carbon. Carbon-14 is radioactive. Carbon-14 acts in kind of the same way that carbon-12 does. It's absorbed into plants through photosynthesis, right? The plants take in carbon dioxide through photosynthesis, and so plants take in C-14 as well, along with the carbon-12, and they're a little bit radioactive. And then animals eat the plants, and we eat the plants, and we eat the animals that eat the plants. So every living thing has a little bit of carbon-14 in them. We're all a little bit radioactive. Not enough that you glow at night and keep your spouse awake, but we're all a little bit radioactive. And when a living thing dies, it obviously stops eating, and so it stops taking in carbon. Stops taking in anything. The carbon-12 stays the same, but the carbon-14 decays over time. It's nuclear decay. It's radioactive. It decays over time back into nitrogen-14, and then it goes back into the atmosphere, and the whole thing starts over again. So the way the measurement happens or the calculation happens of the date is you measure the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-14. And the greater that ratio is, the older the organism is, the further back it died. That's how it works. The greater that ratio, in other words, let me say it simpler. The less carbon-14 there is, the older it is. Because it's decaying over time. Yeah, forget about the carbon-12. But the less carbon-14 there is, the thing is, we have the technology to measure carbon-14 out to about 70, 80, 90,000 years. Not million, 90,000. And that's the oldest that we can get. And so everything that's older than, let's say, 100,000 years should have no detectable carbon-14. We can't detect it. It's too small. The thing is, just about everything that had carbon in it originally, that's supposed to be millions of years old, has carbon-14, has detectable carbon-14. Coal is an example. I mentioned the evolution's Achilles heels project that we did with a 15 PhD scientist and so on. In that documentary, we show a cliff face with different coal seams in it. There's a coal seam and then a layer of rock, another coal seam, a layer of rock, another coal seam, and all the coal, very rich in carbon. And guess what? Every one of those coal seams has carbon-14 in it. They're hundreds of, by the evolutionist dating, they're hundreds of millions of years old. It should have no detectable carbon-14 at all. In fact, if the entire Earth, if every atom of the entire Earth was nothing but carbon-14, after only 1 million years, there should be no detectable carbon-14. Every single atom would have decayed after 1 million years. These coal seams are supposed to be hundreds of millions of years old. They still have detectable carbon-14. And they have the same amount of carbon-14. What does that mean? It means that they're all recent and they were all deposited at about the same time. I love being a Christian. Diamonds, get another example. Diamonds, pure carbon. Hardest natural substance we know of, right? Very difficult to claim that, the diamond has been contaminated with modern carbon-14, has crept in there somewhere. That's very difficult to argue along those lines. It's the hardest natural substance we know of. Guess what scientists find? In amongst the carbon-12 matrix, carbon-14. Diamonds are supposed to be, some people say, billions of years old with a B. It should have decayed long ago, carbon-14. Any of that was encaptured in there when it was crystallized. And it doesn't work. But that's carbon-14. Big problems with that. I shouldn't say there's big problems. It's probably fairly accurate going back to about the time of Christ, going back to about 2,000 years. But before that time, we need to take into consideration what the flood did to the carbon balance in the biosphere, the living world and the atmosphere and so on. It would have dramatically upset the carbon balance in the atmosphere, which means the original carbon that the plants way back then were absorbing through photosynthesis, the ratios are very different, carbon-14 to carbon-12. But we don't know what they were. Nobody does. That information isn't written in the Bible. We get a lot of information in the Bible, but not that information. So the dates going back beyond 2,000 years, they would need some type of a calibration factor. Like maybe it's accurate going back 2,000 years, but maybe a 3,000-year-old date should actually read 2,800 years. And maybe a 5,000-year-old date should actually be 3,500. And maybe a 20,000-year-old carbon-14 date should be, you know, whatever, 3,000 years, something like that, whatever. It needs some kind of a calibration factor. But we wouldn't know what that is because we can guess at the level of carbon that may have been there, but there's huge amounts of guessing. How much plant material was there? How robust were the plants? What was the atmosphere like before the flood? There's a lot of guesswork there. You can be reasonably accurate on some of it, but a lot of it's just guesswork. So, yeah. Anyway, what about the dating methods that do give the millions and billions of years? Those are igneous rocks that are dated that way. You remember your three types of rocks from high school? There's sedimentary, metamorphic, igneous. Igneous rocks are rocks that were once molten. Those are the only rocks that can be dated using this method. So here's how it works. When a rock is thrown up out of the earth, it's molten rock, it cools and solidifies, and that's when the clock starts. And it'll encapsulate something that's radioactive. And evolutionists, for example, uranium decays into lead, potassium into argon, rubidium into strontium. Those are some of the isotopes that evolutionists use, hence the name radioisotope dating. They're radioactive. And so what you do is you measure. See, another misconception. Nobody dates rocks, okay? It's unromantic. No, different. We have telescopes and we have microscopes. We don't have pastoscopes, right? Nobody measures the age of a rock. That's not what's being measured. What's being measured is the amount of the parent product, the radioactive parent product, and the amount of the daughter product that it has decayed into. You measure the amounts of those two isotopes, and then an age is calculated or inferred. It's not measured. They're not measuring dates. That's a misconception there. It's not what's going on. People think, well, this is a rock-solid thing. Well, no. The dates are inferred based on the amounts of some isotopes found in the rock. Here's the problem with that. It's the assumptions. It's very scientific, and people think, well, you know, they've nailed this down with this very scientific-sounding dating method, radioisotope dating. Wow, you know, how can we dispute that? Well, you can't really dispute the science. The science is fine. It's in the assumptions that you make in order to get any kind of calculations at all. There's kind of three major assumptions that you need to make about how the what started. You have to assume, first of all, that when the rock was thrown up out of the earth and cooled and solidified, it didn't already have some of the daughter product in it. You have to assume that. Because if it did, that's going to artificially inflate the date for your rock, right? And there's papers all over the place now that's saying that that's exactly what's happening. Assumption number two, you have to assume that the nuclear decay rates have been constant over time. Well, there's some elements that react to sunspot activity. The nuclear decay rate will change depending on sunspot activity. And there's a book at the back there called Thousands, Not Billions. It's the research results of an intensive, kind of like an eight-year task force by Bible-believing scientists specifically to study radioisotope dating. And there's good evidence that there was dramatically accelerated nuclear decay in the relatively recent past. So that's going to throw off that, you know, assumption number two. Assumption number three, you have to assume that during the history of the life of that rock, none of the parent product or the daughter product were added or removed. In the case of the uranium-lead method, both of those elements dissolve in water. So if that rock was anywhere near, you know, rain or a river or the oceans or whatever, who's to say that more uranium hadn't been leached in or leached out, or lead leached in or leached out? All of those assumptions are play havoc with the dating method. And we've taken some samples from, do we have any Lord of the Rings fans here? You like those movies and that kind of, okay, yeah. You might remember the third movie, Sam and Frodo are climbing up Mount Doom there. Those movies were filmed on a volcano in New Zealand. That volcano where they filmed those movies, there was some lava flows around 1950. So new rock was being produced in 1950. There's newspaper clippings you can see the exact day that these rocks were formed. We've taken samples about 17 years ago, around the year 2000, when those rocks were 50 years old. They're 50-year-old rocks. We've taken samples from those lava flows and sent them away to the same university dating labs that the evolutionists use, and the dates come out, some samples, hundreds of thousands, a few samples into the low millions of years. They're 50-year-old rocks. And the dating method doesn't really work. And it's not because the science is bad. People think that, well, if you don't believe radioisotope dating, you're being very anti-scientific. But no, we're not. Science is okie-dokie. That's no problem there. It's the assumptions that no one can know. How can you know what it had to begin with? How can you know if the decay rate hasn't changed? You can't. So those are the things that make it really squirrely as a dating method. But anyway, so it's almost quarter after nine. We can keep going with a few if you want, but... Yes. Number 12. Where was the Garden of Eden? You know what? We would have no idea. Could have been in Hagersville. No idea. And that might seem like a strange answer, because if you have a study Bible, or if your dad has a study Bible, you can look at the early few chapters of Genesis there. It might have a map of Iraq, what modern day Iraq, or around modern day Iraq, has the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and it says, well, maybe the Garden of Eden was around here somewhere. I disagree. Okay, why do I disagree? It's because those rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, are not the same rivers that were mentioned before the flood. Those rivers today are flowing on top of miles, not just feet, but miles of flood deposited sedimentary rock. Those are post-flood rivers. They're after the flood rivers, not the before the flood rivers that the Bible talks about. So how come they have those names? That's the next question that comes up. How come they have those names? Well, our office is in Kitchener, Ontario, and if you go an hour west or so on the 401, you get to London, Ontario, with the Thames River flowing through London, Ontario. That's not the original Thames River, and that's not the original London, right? How come we have those names in southern Ontario? Well, the answer is, and we know this, because the people that came from the old world across the ocean, they brought those names with them. Maybe the same thing happened after the flood. The ark landed around Iraq after the flood, and so maybe Noah or his wife or their sons or their wives said, you know what, let's name those rivers there the same names that we remember from before the flood. But those are not the same rivers. And they don't even fit the description. The Bible says there was one source and it broke up into four rivers. Today, the Tigris and Euphrates have two different sources, and they flow together. So the description doesn't even fit. But yeah, the Garden of Eden was completely destroyed in the flood. We'd have no idea where it was. Yep. Other, yes. Bristle cone pines, yeah. There's some great articles on bristle cone pines on the website. See if I can remember the conclusions there. But the one of the things is they don't take complete core samples all the way to the base of the tree. They'll take a sample here and a sample there, and sometimes at different depths, and then put them together. And it's well known that trees can produce multiple rings a year, depending on if there's a few weeks of drought in the summer, and then there's a big rain or whatever, that'll produce multiple rings. So you can have that kind of thing there. That's a basic answer, and that's about all I can remember from that. But I'll direct you to the website. Just type in, White Mountain, the bristlecone pines in the White Mountains. And, it turns out that some of the oldest living things, which are trees, the sequoias, for example, and in California, some of the redwoods and so on, but some of those trees they're a few thousand years old, but there's nothing that really is older than the flood. And the trees that are a few thousand years old are middle-aged. In other words, there could be trees that could be much older. These trees are still packing on a lot of weight every year. They're not old, they're not dying. So why aren't there older trees? And it's because of the flood, of course. But you'll get that kind of information and some more details than I can remember right now. Sorry about that. But just go to the website, type in bristlecone pines or tree ring dating. Dendrochronology is what it's called, if you want the technical name. But other, yes? 18? How can we see light from distant galaxies? Yeah, that's a huge question for some people. I met a gentleman last year who rejected Christ outright because of that question specifically. He said that Christians are never, ever going to have an answer to that question. Therefore, the Bible must be wrong. So I don't need to listen to you talk about Jesus, because I already know the Bible's wrong. Now, he was a Christian, because somebody showed him that, okay, there might be some possibilities for that. But some of you probably never thought about that before. How can we see light from distant galaxies? So here's the reason for the question. There are some objects in space, very distant galaxies and quasars and that kind of thing, that are billions of light years away, billions with a B. Now, what's a light year? A light year is a measure of distance. It's the distance that you can travel at the speed of light in a year. So it's a very large distance. So these things are billions of light years away. So all else being equal, if there's been no change to gravity and the speed of light and so on, it would take billions of years for the light that those objects emit to get to our telescopes. So how, if God only created thousands of years ago, how come we're seeing the light from those objects? That's the question for those of you who've never thought about it before. And it's a serious question for, obviously, for some people, they really struggle with it. Now, there's about four different biblically-based models that provide, it's a model that provides an answer to that question. I'll give you one of them, and then we'll maybe end or move on to something else. And we'll do this quickly because it involves Einstein's theory of relativity. And whenever you mention Einstein, things are going to get hairy, right? So Einstein said in the early 1900s, about 100 years ago or so, that gravity affects time. In a stronger gravitational field, time slows down. Okay, so time is not constant. It's relative to gravity, relativity, right? And as weird as that might sound, if you've never heard that before, Einstein was right. Very accurate atomic clocks, for example, low in altitude, closer to the center of the Earth, and a stronger gravitational field, are slower than clocks high in altitude, in a lesser gravitational field. And they're different by the amount of time that Einstein's mathematics says they should be. So Einstein was right. And I used a GPS to get here to the church. The GPS satellites that communicate with the units in our vehicles, they're in a lesser gravitational field. The engineers who designed and built that system, they had to tune the clocks on the satellite to run slower so that they synchronize with the clocks in our vehicles. If they wouldn't have taken into account gravitational time dilation, that's what that's called, every time you turn on your GPS, after an hour, it'll be off by 400 meters. After 2 hours, 800 meters. The system would be useless without taking into account what Einstein said about 100 years ago. So Einstein, as crazy as that sounds, Einstein was right. Now, how does that relate to answering this question? The Bible says in about a dozen different places, God stretched out the heavens like a tent or like a curtain. even implying a fabric to space, which is very interesting to astrophysicists, but that's another question. If God stretched out the heavens, that means before the stretching, everything was closer together, right? And if everything used to, if it started off closer together, that means there's, and if the Earth is near the center of the universe, and there's good evidence that it is, but that's another question, the gravity around the Earth would have been very high. Well, gravity way out here, where there's hardly any matter, is very low. So if you have a big difference in the in gravity, you have a big difference in the rate at which time passes. So it's possible that while minutes or seconds tick by on Earth, millions or billions of years elapse way out here, plenty of time to allow the light from these objects to get to Earth, so that on day six of creation, when Adam and Eve look up at the night sky, they see approximately the same night sky we see today. So I'm going to leave it at that. I'm getting kind of a deer in the headlights looks from some people here, but what? Gravity affects time? But there's a great chapter in the Creation Answers.